We have him back. That's the song there, John Lennon, about his mum. That's called Julia. So Hunter, as I was saying, like, he really is a bit of kind of, he's like, you know, witty and outspoken and interesting. He's kind of mad and sarcastic. As I say, he really is a bit of everything, isn't he?
And he's very abusive.
Yeah.
And he's very funny. But what I suppose surprised me, and perhaps a lot of people who roughly know all those things about him, is that there's quite a lot of sensitive, sweet stuff in the book. I'm thinking of the letters to his cousin called Leela.
Particularly, yes.
She was his older cousin who became a doctor, so she was the so-called clever one. She just died, by the way, in August.
Oh.
So when he's writing to her, he's not swearing, he's not doing clever puns or stream of consciousness, and he's not being silly. He's just reminiscing about their childhood, about Liverpool, and also about Scotland, where they had lots of family holidays. I just remember lying in bed at night at Christmas time and watching the light, all those sort of soppy sentimental things, which he does nicely, but you don't expect it of John Lennon, do you?
No, see, that's probably the point. And this Leela person, who I had never heard of before this, to be honest.
But you wouldn't. She was never interviewed. I did approach her 2 years ago. She has a half-brother called David Birch. He's not known. He's another full cousin to John. And he, behind the scenes, was incredibly helpful to me. But he hasn't been interviewed or is known either. And he's alive and well. And he supplied that very first letter in the book was to his mother. And
oh, yeah.
When he's aged 10, you know that little letter?
Yeah.
Which is funny because he says it's the best towel I've ever had. And you think age 10 he's been mocking. But obviously age 10 he's probably had several towels, so he's being serious.
Yeah, no, it's thank you for the book and the towel. I think it's the best towel I've ever seen.
It's
fantastic. But I mean, like Leela, like, I mean, one of the things he does say to her is that the family now look at me always in terms of dollars. Like around 67, 68, when he sort of, if you like, dropped Cynthia and found Yoko and that, he did become very, very, like, nasty, very not nice, and the drugs had a lot to do with it.
I don't know about that. It was the falling out with the Beatles. They're suing each other over Alan Klein and Apple.
Yeah.
And the awful things, I mean, there's some awful things in the book. The rant letter to Paul, where he's effing and blinding and saying horrible things. Paul has always been very mature and never replied to that at the time or since. But the real background to that awful, outrageous, ranting rubbish is not drugs and it's not fury. In my mind, he's protecting Yoko. Yoko's come into his life. All the media seem to hate Yoko. He gets into his head the other Beatles hate her, which I think they probably did. And he's got in his head that Paul and Linda have been horrible to her. So he's really lashing out because he's protecting the woman he loves.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in one of the letters, he goes on about the fact that people from the Orient, if you like, don't sweat as much as everybody else.
That's one of my... Have you got it in front of you?
No, I don't. But, I mean, I could open it there. But
roughly... it's one of the funniest letters in the book. He's writing to the laundry.
Yeah.
Bob knows how this letter turned up. It's in handwriting, and obviously somebody in the laundry bagged it. Ha, 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 that's a joke. And it's later been sold at an auction. Anyway, he writes in the laundry saying, "Dear laundry, my wife does not, will not, never shall, never has done, dyed her hair. Orientals don't sweat the way we do. So what is your excuse for turning my white shirt yellow?"
I mean, like, see, this is one of the things. There's so much unguarded stuff in the book. It's actually quite remarkable. On one level, like, you know, does it tell us a lot? Like, obviously, this is an autobiography of John Lennon that we've never come across before. In one way, you, Hunter Davies, has not written this in any way, even though you explain everything, which is something you definitely have to do. You give opinions. You make sure to place everything in the proper context. There's information, there's insight, there's comments. And they're essential, by the way. This wouldn't have worked without that. But essentially, like, on the other side of it, it's an autobiography of John Lennon, which we've never had before.
You actually get closer to John, I think, than you do in a biography. In a way, it's nearer the truth than a diary. Not that we know that John left diaries, but in diaries, you're vaguely performing. You actually
yes.
half think somebody's going to read it.
And that's why I said the word unguarded. And it's the unguarded
as a letter, it's thrown off instantly. He's writing for one particular person to amuse them at one particular time. And he gives away how he feels. It is a performance in the sense that he's tailoring his views to the person he's writing to. And he's tailoring, as we all do, he tells certain things to certain people that you might not tell your mum. So he's doing that with all these people. Of course, the other joy of John Lennon letters is the fact that almost every letter from the very beginning is decorated. Because he was an artist and because he went to art school, he does doodles, either him and himself naked, him and Yoko naked, or he does little cartoons. And also, if he's writing on headed notepaper, he redraws the notepaper to make it funny, like American Airlines. He writes in funny things. In one of the letters to Leela, the woman we mentioned earlier, his cousin, at the top of one page to her, he's drawn in a sort of green felt pen a row of palm trees.
Yeah.
Behind one of the palm trees, you can see a pyramid. Then you can see a little face peeping out with his National Health spectacles on. That's John. And the joke there is that Leela was born in Egypt. I couldn't work out why he's doing these palm trees.
Okay.
Yeah. Born in Egypt. So he's doing it, what he thinks of the pyramids is an Egyptian visual joke.
Okay, but like what he was doing here, like, I mean, he wrote all sorts of letters to all sorts of people in all sorts of different ways. And like, as I say, Unguarded is the one that gets for me. So it tells you an awful lot about the time in terms of the nature of celebrity. I mean, fans had a direct line. He writes unguardedly to a friend, a fan, a journalist, whoever it happens to be, things that would never happen today.
Yeah, well, he was the Beatles at their height were probably getting 10,000 letters a week. I'm only guessing that, but I did see masses and masses of postmen arriving. And most of them were dumped. They lay around for a few weeks, few months, and then some assistant burned them. But now and again, John Potato would dip his hand in, pull out a letter, make some abusive, silly joke about it. But now and again, something would strike him, and he would write back to that person. And on the whole, that person never published them. That person eventually might have sold them because they were hard up. There's that nice letter to this girl, Sandra Clark, who's age 14 in 1960, whatever it was, 63. And she's a fan, writes to him, and she asks the question which lots of girls were asking at the time, are you married? Now, Brian Epstein made the Beatles, made John Lennon keep it secret, the fact that he was married and had a child, because Brian, in the 60s, thought it would work against their fan base, if people knew one of them, the leader, was married. But this girl gets a letter back that says, blah, blah, dear Sandra, yes, I'm married to Cindy. So he's married to Cynthia, as you know. And this letter, of course, is the first one I come across in which he admits to an unknown fan. He's married. This girl, by the way, age 14, 20 years later, in the 1980s, she's 34. She's got three children. And on the same day, the boiler bursts and the dishwasher packs up. And she thinks, what can I do to get some money quickly? So she sells this letter, which nobody's ever seen, at Sotheby's for £440. The fool, if she saved it to today, be worth about 15,000 to 20,000.
Yeah. And there's a bunch of others too, like, you know, there's Gene, the Maharishi in The Search for Truth, there's the Sylvia and Kathy one of where he actually gives out the home address of the other three Beatles, which is brilliant. There's also Beth about Transcendental Meditation.
What's so sweet about those early fan letters when they just had one record, or perhaps two, he's writing, he replies to his fans by hand, and he gives away the home addresses of the other Beatles and tells you how many brothers and sisters George has, because they all want to know that, and Ringo. He gives away these personal details. It's all so innocent, really, isn't it?
Oh, no, well, that's the whole point. Now, one of the things I want to mention here also, just about, is the detail of, it's well known that John Lennon was brought up by his Aunt Mimi, got to know his mother a little bit later, and just as he was really getting to know his mother and, like, being almost in love with his mother, she gets killed in a crash. Now, and that's Julia. In fact, I'm going to play the song Julia in a second or two, but before I do, tell me about just what might be there in terms of Aunt Mimi and Julia.
In the letters?
Yeah.
Well, very little. There's a few scraps to Mimi. I don't know what happened to the letters to Mimi, but I'm not quite sure of the question.
Well, no, what I mean is by that is that
there are no letters to Julia that I came across.
No, but what I mean by that is that he...
life, you mean?
Yeah, no, he had a thing with Aunt Mimi that he always thought Aunt Mimi was great, but we found out subsequently that she wasn't.
Oh, right, sorry. No, the relationship with Aunt Mimi was up to the age of 10. He adored her and was very happy and lovely. And then as a teenager, he got bolshy, and Mimi was a very strong, old-fashioned disciplinarian. And she was a terrible snob. She didn't like him playing with George and Paul because George and Paul were low class and came from council estates. where she, Mimi, lived in a little boring, prim little semi. So she was very aware of so-called common people. So, and she didn't like him playing the guitar. She made him play outside. Didn't like his friends. Didn't like his lack of interest at school. But she got him into art college. He was the one that forced, and plus the headmaster, to get him into art college when he passed no exam and was absolutely useless and feckless and no interest. It was in fights and stealing things. So it was a love-hate relationship between them. But not long ago, a couple of years ago, Julia Baird, who is John's half-sister, the daughter of Julia, they didn't really know each other, but they grew up vaguely in the end aware of each other. Anyway, Julia has done this amazing research and has proved that Mimi was a widow for most of John's childhood. The man was, he was a milkman and a little farmer, the one who died. And she took in lodgers. And it turns out that Mimi, while John was still living here, Mimi was shagging one of the lodgers, the young men there, a PhD student at Liverpool University. And he's been tracked down to, I think, New Zealand, and he's apparently admitted it, which is amazing. Now, if John were alive today and heard this story about his uptight, bossy, moralistic Aunt Mimi, I think his first thing would have hysterical laughter.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be true. The letters themselves, I mean, they are collectible to spectacularly valuable. I presume you did a bit of Hercule Poirot and Sherlock Holmes to track these down.
Well, the copyright of them belongs to Yoko, because the law of copyright in Ireland, in America, England, is roughly the same. It belongs to the person that wrote it or their estate for 70 years. So these letters have never been published in any book form because you have to get the copyright permission. So I got that from Yoko, who greatly helped me and supported the venture, but she actually has got no Lennon letters. She had some scraps, but she got stolen. So I've had to track down, well, there's almost 300 there, I had to track each one down by writing to friends, family, thinking of who might have them. I fiddle the definition of the word letter. I've expanded it like elastic, so letters cover postcards, laundry lists, domestic lists, all bits and pieces. It's really John's, as it were, non-musical writing. That's what it covers.
But I mean, also, like, for instance, like, there's a handwritten lyrics for Give Peace a Chance I know has gone for nearly $500,000. This is the kind of money we're talking about. There's a list of songs to...
The lyrics are much more expensive. The most valuable lyrics is A Day in the Life. That's gone for $1 million.
Written on what? Just a piece of paper?
On a scrap of paper. The lyrics, if you've got lyrics by John or Paul or George, the handwritten lyrics, they are very obviously limited because probably only 2-3 of every song exists in different forms. And those are incredibly valuable because everybody knows Yesterday or Hard Day's Night or all those things.
Right, of course, yeah.
But everybody around the world who's multi-millionaire likes to have it in their den. The letters are not as valuable. They're still amazingly valuable. As I said, the cheapest letter you can probably get is probably 7,000.
Right, yeah.
And for a really exciting one with good content, you pay 20,000. It's still incredible.
It really is. By the way, we're talking to Hunter Davies. It's called The John Lennon Letters by John Lennon, edited by Hunter Davies, and a lot of detective work has gone into it. And this is the book that I said, this should be a bit of a laugh, another side of John Lennon. I never thought I'd get so into it and find out so much about John Lennon that I mightn't have known, and that I see it as an autobiography and very comprehensive too.
Oh, that's a good description.
Okay, now, just let's take a look at, like, there's one thing about it that does come through a lot, and we always knew this about John, the childish humour. Do you think that he was constantly funny, or was it a disturbing tendency not to mature?
Oh, he was both. He could be... When I was doing my biography hundreds of years ago, 66, 68, George was the most serious because he was heavily into Indian religion and Indian music. Didn't want to talk about the Beatles, and he was very, very philosophical, and he would grind on about his theories of, you know, Hindu religion. John could also be very serious in telling you things he'd discovered. He was into religion as well. But at the same time, all of them, even George, but mainly John, could be very funny. And his first reaction the first reaction to himself being pompous and serious was to prick his own bubble, was to sort of mock himself. And that's one of the joys of his songs. Even when he's writing serious songs, he can often start up laughing and mocking it and putting on silly voices. So he was serious and he was jocular.
All right, but some of the things, like, for instance, I didn't know that it was John and et cetera who pushed back the release of Paul's first solo album to make Let It Be happen, and Paul didn't necessarily even know this. I mean,
this was the row between them. They'd all fallen out. The Beatles were splitting up. Yeah. They wanted divorces, John particularly, and George wanted to get away from it. And they felt, after Brian Epstein down, they fell out over who should be their manager, who should look after them. So this is the sort of antipathy between them. They're going their separate ways, doing separate songs.
So 68, 69, if it goes bad, do you think that the relationship with Paul in the next 10 years and just never really got together at all? Because Paul would say that, you know...
I think by the time that John died, there was a rapprochement between them.
Yeah.
They were seeing each other and being civil, but they were never as close as they had been.
Okay, well, I just want to play you a tiny little bit of a few bits and pieces of the Beatles that I've interviewed. This is just Paul, kind of on that. And by the way, Paul gives away something here that you might be interested in about a letter. Hold on just one second. I'll dip into this interview.
The last conversation you had with John was pretty damn good.
Oh,
compared
yeah,
to some previous ones.
The last few conversations were great. No, yeah. It really was like a saving grace for me. Because, you know, we had some terrible things. We just ring up and, like, scream at each other and just take the mickey, you know, and just, like, insult each other and then hang up on each other. It was, like, real typical male ego stuff, you know. But what turned out to be towards the end of his life, we had some great times because he just had Sean. So suddenly he had somebody he could relate to me. You know, it was like he had a baby and he was, like, a great dad. Finally... Because, you know, he hadn't been able to be a great dad to Julian. And I think it saddened him that. There's a letter, actually, that I bought at auction for Julian, where John's writing to Cynthia, and it sort of says, I can't believe... He's on tour with the Beatles. He says, I can't believe when I was home last time, I was reading the newspaper, and Julian was there in the room, and I wasn't even looking at him.
Yeah.
When I come home next time, don't worry, I'll play with the baby. And sort of, so, you know, he knew all that. Anyway, finally, you know, we had some great conversations, yeah, about, you know, what you're doing now. I'm baking bread. Hey, we just had a bread strike here. I'm baking bread. What recipe do you use, love? You know, it was all that. It was like real stuff. And, you know, I'm just putting the cats out, you know. Oh, yeah, I'm just wandering around in a robe, a dressing gown, you know, I'm just padding around the apartment. So for me, that was really great. It was really cool to sort of get back to, like, who we were, just two mates.
Right.
Even though it was on the end of a phone, it was very nice. It meant it was even more of a shock when he was killed, you know. But we did have those last moments, and it was really something I'm very thankful
for. He's really something he's very thankful for.
Was that you doing the interview?
Yeah. Yeah.
What was funny was that Paul was speaking in an Irish accent. He was being more Liverpool and being more Liverpool Irish because he was speaking to you. No, that's what I just said to you. Towards the end, there was a rapprochement. Yeah. That letter he bought for Julian, by the way, is in the book.
All right, yeah. Oh, so, really? Oh, right, because I've read the things. I didn't know
that
was
what he gave it to Julian, and Julian has published it.
I didn't realise that was the one. All right, okay.
Yeah, that's the one, yes.
All right.
He talks about how awful he was with Julian and how he missed it all and how he's going to be a really good father this time.
Right, yeah. And, of course, Hey Jude, etc., we all know about Julian, etc. The honesty and the innocence, Hunter, in the thing. Like, I mean, you know, they do reflect the era, really, don't they, as much as they do his personality. It's a history book in some ways.
It is. I tried to sort of tie it as roughly to the times without making it too political. All the campaigns he got into, a lot of them you can't understand them now, but he did try to back various left-wing and political causes. So that's a period piece. And the drugs and the Indian stuff and the Indian mysticism, they were sort of leaders in that, and that's a period piece as well.
Yeah. Okay, there was sometimes, in one letter you could have... He was cocky, he was mischievous, he was fun, then suddenly he was self-important, there was a lot of self-pity as well. And not all the letters are to people. I mean, it's all over the place in terms of, as you say, the bits and pieces. But he could be everything in one simple letter, couldn't he?
He could be, yeah. as I say, when he was being pompous and showing off, he was usually self-aware. I mean, there's that lovely, there's that, Yoko and him write this very pompous message to the world in the New York Times, a letter. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is absolutely slobby. And then a few weeks later, John does a mock, a joke version of it to the great, what's it called again? The Great Wok. And I want to talk to my people. And then their invention of utopia, not utopia, newtopia.
Yeah.
Remember, everybody becomes a citizen. It's done on April the 1st. And that's a good joke. It creates a new country, which is an abstract concept, the country.
And
that everybody wants to be is a citizen.
Right, and there's also to-do lists in the thing, which I think are hilarious. They're a bit like mine. But look, did fame come between John and his family? And do you get that from the letters?
There's a bit of that, yeah, because one or two of them tried to get money off him. And John was incredibly generous, so he did actually, without me asking, would buy houses for them, like he bought a house for his dad, Fred Lennon. But because of his accountants and the people actually doing the buying and doing the paperwork, the houses always remained in John's ownership. And that led subsequently to lots of trouble and lots of rows. Because the people were given a house, they lived in it for free, didn't have to pay rent, and they actually thought they owned it, the freehold. So there's lots of jealousy between members of the family that hadn't got the houses. And then when they found out the house didn't actually belong to them when the person died, they thought they might. So he was very generous that way. And also, I suppose, the other thing that happens with famous people, especially a famous person like John, who was a loudmouth, who would say things to amuse himself and to shock and to be outrageous. So he would do interviews when he was in America and rubbish people and rubbish things and talk about his life and talk about... And now and again, he would upset members of his family like Mimi or his cousins or whatever back in England. And that's one of the reasons Leela, his cousin's writing to him, because he's, I don't know what it is at the time, I haven't found it out.
Right.
But he's obviously in an interview said something awful. Now, you and I know, being journalists and broadcasters, you cut out the boring stuff. And you only use the good stuff, don't you? The funny stuff.
Well, in many ways, unless, of course, the live interview and everything just is thrown in there. Listen,
yeah.
I tell you, I just want to get to one little piece here that I'm going to play one other piece. We're talking about the John Lennon letters by John Lennon, by the way, edited by Hunter Davies. Cynthia had a very hard time because John Lennon was married to Cynthia throughout all of Beatlemania and all the 60s. And she was unceremoniously dumped in many ways on that famous trip to Wales when the train went out of the station and she was left behind, etc. And really, that was the end of it all. But she did...
That was an accident. She wasn't...
Well, no, hold on. I know it was an accident. In fact, John was leaning out the window saying, come on, Sin. But by the same token, she knew that when that train left the station, that was John leaving her life. And then don't forget, like, they went to Wales and that's where the manager of the Beatles
died. I was
on
the train and I know exactly what happened. I was in the carriage. She just missed it. The
yeah.
roadie stayed with her.
I realised that. But the point
symbolic,
about it is...
Symbolic.
It was symbolic, exactly, yeah. But she did meet John in art college and John stood out because she was from a very different kind of background. And I just want to take a little bit of what she said in an interview that we did a little while back. And this is Cynthia Lennon, as in
right.
John Lennon's wife.
Nobody could compare with John's lunacy, John's wit and John's rebelliousness. And I think that was the excitement, you know, from coming from that sort of quiet, not necessarily prim, but quiet and well brought up. And I respected my parents and everything else. And I really wanted to be a teacher in life. I wanted to do the right thing instead of a bank manager, as parents, you know, in those days
sure.
wanted you to be a bank manager or something like that. But just by meeting him and experiencing his presence, because he had such charisma and such a presence from everybody in college. I mean, everybody knew John. Everybody fell about laughing. He disrupted the classes. He was a nightmare for the tutors and the lecturers. But it was something that I wanted to know more about him. And I certainly did quite quickly.
Okay, but it was just a few months after his mum had died in a tragic
yeah.
car crash. She was knocked down by a... What was it? It was a drunk police officer
who was
an L plate driver as well
yeah.
who hit the wrong
yeah.
thing. Yeah. Okay. So like he was one of these guys who was rebelling against something. I mean, the past that you had, the family you had was pretty damn great. The
I
family
was very lucky.
He had was not good at all.
It was a nightmare.
And in fact, some of those books that I've read down through the years, this Aunt Mimi person who brought him up seemed to be a great person. Now, I've seen since, and don't forget, she survived 11 years after John's death and was able to give interviews in the one-sided story. She was a pain in the ass.
She was to me. She really gave me a hard time. She gave John a really hard time. His friends were never welcome. And she was always criticising everything that he did. So she wasn't encouraging him to blossom or bloom in any direction. She just wanted him to do as he was told, get his grades at school, behave himself. And that wasn't John. I mean, John was a natural rebel. I mean, he had to be because he lost his father. You know, his father left when he was a little boy. And, of course, when his mother died after, you know, just getting to know her, I mean, really, really falling in love with his mother, which sounds strange, but because of the person she was and because of her musical talent and her fun, compared to Mimi's austerity and misery. I mean, she was always moaning she didn't have enough money, she didn't have that. She was, and as I said in the book that John had said, you know, all Mimi cares about is cats and money.
Cats, money and John.
Yes. John, of course.
Yeah, and keeping people away from John because you would never be good enough for John, as neither would anybody else.
No, I never was.
Yeah, exactly.
Until later on, and I went to the funeral of his aunt, and Mimi was there, and she really berated me for divorcing John.
That's right, yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. I mean, she never had a nice word to say for me any time. And then she actually told me off at her sister's funeral for allowing John to get away and go off with Yoko. I mean, I couldn't do anything right, but I did speak to her before she died, so we sort of made a little bit of peace because she was very ill.
Cynthia Lennon, John Lennon's first wife, that's just a little sort of, like, I'm trying to kind of take a look, Hunter, at just like the difference between the way John and Paul were brought up and the kind of family background they both had.
Can I just make one point?
Yeah.
All those things that Cynthia says and we've been saying is true. John was like that. In Mimi's defence, she was caring for him and loving him, even though she was austere. But what happens with this tame psychology today, it happens in all forms of life and all families, you try to explain why John was rebellious and horrible and cruel because of his mother dying and being brought up by Mimi. But by the same token, Paul was never horrible and cruel. Paul was never rebellious. Paul was always charming and polite. And yet at the same age, roughly, age 40, he lost his mother.
Good point, yeah.
And so why didn't that affect him? And the answer is John was innately John. It's the genes and how it happened. And Paul was Paul. They're two different characters. So I don't think really you can blame the background and things that happened.
No, that's a very good point. And also that goes back to what I said earlier about what you do with the book here. I mean, you were a friend of John Lennon's, but you do include dissenting comments and opinions. And that's one of the reasons why I would like this and see it as a proper comprehensive autobiography. Even though, as you say, you didn't really write it. He did. Although all the stuff that you put to explain the letters and put them in context is vitally important. It just wouldn't work otherwise. So finally, Hunter, overall, what do we get out of this book here? This is just a bunch of stuff that John Lennon wrote, and people wrote an awful lot more years ago and postcards and letters than they seem to now, because we're not going to get the tweets of bloody some guy out of One Direction, or we're not going to get the emails of somebody else from the Killers. So the point is there a story here about John Lennon because of these letters?
Well, it's a near, you said autobiography, which it isn't technically, but I can see what you mean, and that's a good description. It's probably the nearest you'll get to John Lennon without it being varnished by other people, by third persons. You also see the full range of his character, and you also see elements of his character you don't normally think about, the sentimental, soft, sincere side. So you get a fairly rounded view of John Lennon.
That's it in a nutshell, all right. Okay, well, on today, the 8th of December, 32 years since John Lennon was shot dead in New York City, the book is called The John Lennon Letters. It's by John Lennon, as I say, edited by Hunter Davies, published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson, and it's on release right now in your local bookshop. Hunter Davies, thanks a million for talking to us, Hunter.
Pleasure. That was very good. You're very knowledgeable. Thanks so much. Bye.
Thank you, Hunter. Good luck.